Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Some of the most obvious things are hard to see. One is change. We live in a world of accelerating transition, so much, so fast, that it is hard to recall what life was like in the recent past. We can read about it, of course, but it's another thing to see it. And you can do just that at Fort Benton, Montana. Randy Morger's executive director of the River and Plains Society, based in Fort Benton. Randy, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for having me.
We're standing in the Strand Gallery of the Museum of the Northern Great Plains, and directly in front of us are six mounted bison, including a huge bull. There's an informational plaque referring to William Hornady. I remember the name, but don't know why.
Well, he later became one of probably the most famous conservationists from the early 20th century, along with Muir, along with Teddy Roosevelt. It is Hornaday's name who's associated with conservation in the United States.
So what did he have to do with the bison we're looking at?
He was sent out here in 1886 by the Smithsonian to take some of the last surviving buffalo that had roamed from those 40 to 60 million that we believe had roamed the Great Plains before that. And his job, because the folks at the Smithsonian were absolutely certain that the bison would be soon extinct, his job was to take some of the last few of these and put them into a display so that the American people would know forever what it was they had lost.
The potential extermination of the bison would have marked a colossal ecological event, but I gather it had something to do with the evolving history of the state of Montana significantly as well. Fair?
Well, absolutely, and I can't think of a better word to describe it than poignant. It was the absolute passing of an era. The United States knew that unless the bison were removed from the plains, the Indians could never be reserved. And until the Indians were reserved, it could never be a place where European Americans, Euro-Americans, could come in and settle and bring in their own civilization.
When you say reserved, you mean put on restricted land called reservations?
Exactly, put on the reservations. And so it was the passing of the bison that opened up an era here for the Euro-Americans to come in and settle the land, and that's the whole purpose behind the Museum of the Northern Great Plains, to show that transition into the opening of the land to cattle and to sheep, and the opening of the land to agriculture and homesteaders.
Opening up the country to immigrants, we think in one sense of covered wagons, but at the scale you're talking about, I'm gathering it was something different.
Well, and that was another big changing of the guard that was taking place. Once again, Fort Benton had been the centerpiece for transportation into the area by virtue of being at the head of transportation on the Missouri River as far as you could bring a major boat inland. And that was all changing in the early 1880s into the state of Montana as the railroads proceeded westerly across the state, and here for Fort Benton in 1887 when the first railroad came in just on the bluffs overlooking the town.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, when Hornady killed those bison, which were almost extinct, cattle had already moved into the country, right?
Well, absolutely. Since the 1860s, 1870s, there had been entrepreneurs who had been bringing in huge cattle ranches into this area, but it was only with the complete elimination of the cattle that they were free to take their own business across the open range.
Okay, now we're standing in front of a diorama in the museum, and it says end of the open range, 1886-87, coincidentally the same time of Hornady's buffalo. So what are we looking at?
And isn't it interesting that just at the time of the end of that major buffalo hunt that he held in the fall of 1886, there came the major storm that Charlie Russell described in one of his most iconic little sketchings of the skeletal cow, rather. This is a period where even as the open range was being opened, the whole system was going to change because ranchers knew after the great depletion of the cattle as a result of that blizzard that they were going to have to change their way of doing business. They would have to start fencing. They would have to start taking care of their cattle in the wintertime, raising hay and so forth. And so their system of how they would ranch was changing almost at the same time.
Just to emphasize that, open range means you just turn out your cattle, period.
Yes, with very broad geographic areas. In fact, we had a number of cattle ranchers here in the Scioto County area whose ranches ran all the way from the Highwood Mountains, 20 miles to our south, all the way to the Medicine Line or the Canadian border, which is 100 miles to our north. And these were huge, huge ranges that they ran their cattle on.
We've moved to another room, and we're looking at what I will call an idyllic portrayal of homesteading. Substantial house, in the distance a man with the plow being pulled by two horses, and in the foreground a mother and daughter. The daughter's caressing a sheep, and standing next to the mother is an antelope calf. What does this painting signify to you?
Well, this is one of my favorite paintings. This is for those who knew Bob Morgan. This is a Bob Morgan original mural. It's one of five big murals that we have at the Montana Agricultural Center. And as you described it, this is actually a redo of a photograph that Evelyn Cameron had done back in eastern Montana, juxtaposed over northern Scioto County as we look north toward the Goosebill. And this, I would say, would be what the homesteaders, as they begin their massive influx into Montana in the early 1900s through 1910, 1915 time period, what they believed homesteading would be like, would be a land of milk and honey with incredibly beneficent rains and soils, and that they would be able to come in and actually make a very substantial living and make their way in this new land.
Now, my recollection is weak on the Homestead Act. What were the basic provisions?
Well, the first Homestead Act was actually set up in 1862, signed by President Lincoln, and it provided to certain people and in certain places 160 acres of essentially free land if you did certain things with that land. And so there were homesteaders in Montana from, well, actually the first came into the Helena area in about 1867. So there were homesteaders who had come into Montana up until the period we're talking about, the early 1900s. But you have to remember, out here in central Montana, eastern Montana, 160 acres was not going to provide a living for a homesteader.
Okay, you can't make it on 160 acres in central Montana with a horse and plow, yet people continued to homestead. Something changed. What and how?
That's why we're standing in front of this diorama now, which is in the main lead-in room to our Museum of the Northern Great Plains, and it's a small homage to U.S. Representative Charles Prey, who served in the U.S. House of Representatives for three terms from 1906 to 1914. It was during this period in 1909 that the U.S. Congress first expanded, for the first time since 1862, the Homestead Act that Lincoln had established, which made now the ability to go in and get free land to the tune of a half a square mile, 320 acres. And then Judge Prey was responsible in 1912 to putting in a stipulation through Congress that said instead of having to sit on that land for 5 years in order to get that land essentially for free, you only had to have a 3-year prove-up.
And additionally, it says here you only had to live on the land 7 months a year, which suggests either you didn't have to tough it out through the winter and or you could supplement your income through some sort of other work. Fair?
Well, exactly. And for those who know the land out here in central Montana, you know that it can get pretty desperate out on the plains in the middle of the winter.
Representative Prey obviously had a profound impact on homesteading. Where was he from and where did he come to Montana?
Well, he came from back east, I want to say Vermont, and he actually came to Fort Benton and established a law practice in 1892. After that, took up as a county prosecutor, and then he did his three terms in Congress. Following that, came back to Montana, actually resettled in Great Falls, and was a judge appointed by Calvin Coolidge, a federal judge, for many years until his retirement in 1957, and he died in 1963.
I remember talking with an elderly woman who grew up on a homestead, and she described to me how terribly lonely it was and what a joy it was for her to be able to go into town. We're standing in front of a diorama, a photograph of a town. What are we looking at?
And actually, this is Carter, Montana. It's one of the few homestead communities which are still in existence in Scioto County. If you took a look at a map of Scioto County, even after it had been reduced in size in 1920, an area of some 90 miles east to west and 60 miles north to south had probably well over two dozen homestead communities scattered around it.
And how many are there now?
Well, now in terms of population, we probably have five communities left that have population of any size at all. Most of the rest of them are long gone. There may be an old foundation for a grain elevator there, but in most cases they're reduced to dusty photographs and memories.
So tell us about this town and what period we're talking about, the photograph and their small buildings that replicate parts of the town.
We set this up as sort of an homage to those disappeared homestead villages. Now, Carter, Montana is still in existence. It's on the road between Great Falls and Fort Benton, and it's one of the few that still has population in it. A fellow by the name of Jack Castor, a wonderful Carter resident some years ago, did a wooden diorama of many of the major streets and major structures in town. So we show these along with the photographs of Carter to show people what life was like for people who wanted to, who had to get in and do their business and conduct business in one of the communities that weren't more than a day's drive, buckboard drive, away from their homestead. That's why these existed.
Do business in town. What kind of business?
Well, it would have been just about everything, all the way from doing legal business. You see there a Carter Commission Company is one of the things in the diorama. Obviously, the train station and the things that were being brought in, the blacksmith shops, the barber shops, the general stores. In fact, what we see here, we'll see again in just a few moments when we walk out into a more generic homestead village that we have set up here in Fort Benton as part of the Montana Agricultural Center.
There's also a bar.
There is, and so you would say that if it was there, it was obviously prior to the beginning of Prohibition, which was coming in just about the same time that photograph was taken, about 1919 or 1920, and which ran through the early 1930s. When we go out to our homestead village, there is no bar, but you'll see some curtained areas behind several of the common areas in the general store where people probably would have slipped behind.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Randy Morger, director of the Museum of the Northern Great Plains, about the transition in Montana to homesteading. Now, we started in 1886-87 with the Hornady Bison. We're now around 1919-1920. What's happened in terms of population in this area or in the state of Montana during that time?
Well, let's step back first to the state of Montana itself. If you were to look at the turn of the last century, 1900 census, probably in round numbers about 250,000 people statewide. That went up dramatically over the course of the next 20 years, a great deal of that due to the homesteader influx. For example, in 1910, 325,000 people was the state population.
We went from 250 to 325 in 10 years.
So basically a 50% increase in population in that 10-year period. And then by 1920, it had doubled from 1910, 250,000 in 1910, to more than 520,000 people in 1920, which would have been the height of the homestead era.
Now, most of these homesteaders are engaged in what I assume is dry farming, no irrigation. What are they growing and selling?
Yeah, a significant difference from what they were seeing in Iowa or even Nebraska, where there was enough rain to take them through a good year producing crops such as corn. Out here, it was mainly the grass crops, and of those, wheat, and certainly for the Choteau County area, winter wheat would have been their big crop.
Now, that in it, obviously a fundamental economic reality, but also there was an ecological reality, conversion of former grasslands, rather famous grasslands, into farmlands. Fair?
Well, absolutely. What you saw were the ancient grasses that had grown up here over thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and had acclimated to life out here. When that got changed to wheat, barley, rye, and oats, a much more short-rooted sort of a crop, the ecology did change. And one of the things that we've seen, and seen for a long period of time, saline seep is a result of wheat production as opposed to the deeper grasses that had been here prior to that.
The term saline seep.
Well, essentially, since we were at the bottom of a vast sea at one point in time, unless there's grass with roots that is sucking up the salt from out of there, if you have shorter rooted grasses like wheat or barley, then that salt can actually migrate to low-lying areas. And so a lot of places in the central part of Montana where you see big white, what look to be like big alkali lakes, that's actually saline seep.
One of your displays shows some of the grass's interesting names: little blue stem, blue bunch wheatgrass, prairie June grass, green and needle grass, needle and thread, rough fescue. Very interesting. We're now outside. You may get a little wind noise. We're standing in what looks like the main street of a very small old town. What are we looking at?
And this would be a reproduction. Actually, many of these buildings are original, drug from various homestead communities, both around Choteau County and outside, some of which are reproductions. But this would be what you might consider to be a generic homestead village. Not all look like this, but this kind of gives you a central point of what some of the businesses would have been back in the early 1920s to mid-1920s, let's say.
We're standing in front of what I'm going to call the world's smallest gas station, two pumps, and a building that looks like maybe 15 by 8 feet, which is the office, an old cash register, ceramic 4-gallon jug that says battery water. And I want to describe the pumps to our listeners. I ran into one of these on a ranch when I cowboyed in the Madison Valley in 1969. You crank the pump and fill a gas tank that is above, it's about 8 feet high. It's a glass cylinder with markings that'll hold up to 10 gallons. And then when you get the gas pumped up, it's gravity feed when you put the nozzle in your gas tank. What are we looking at?
Well, actually, this is very much part of the era, although it looks more modern. It's an Art Deco gas station that came to us from Hobson, Montana, and it dates back to the 1920s. So in these homestead villages, you might very well see a service station like this for the still relatively new automobiles that were coming into the country during that time.
And on the pump, there's a sign that says, contains lead, filled with the days of leaded gasoline. We're standing in the doorway of a building that might be 8 feet tall, 12 by 10 perhaps. Tell us what's inside.
Well, again, what we are is looking into one of these, and they were called homestead shanties, and shanties for a reason, a very small wooden structure that could have been built on site, but might have been dragged behind a buckboard or otherwise brought out to one of those 320-acre homesteads. And this would have served as the first, and perhaps for the first 3 to 5 years, a homestead family of husband, wife, and many kids would have lived in here. When you see the bedstead, the table, the stove, and cracks in the walls where they would have had a lot of cold wind blowing in on them if they didn't get it sealed up. But pretty rude furnishings to get your start out here on the Great Plains.
And is that a bedpan I see underneath the bed?
And that would be a bedpan you see there. And there probably would have been out on one side, obviously, the outhouse. But even water, they might not even have water out here. They might have had to bring that in from a well far, far away. So pretty primitive living.
A little further down the street, there's a building the same size as what we were just looking at, even a little smaller. A sign on the top says Volunteer Fire Department. Little different than what we think of as fire departments today. I assume inside was a horse-drawn water wagon?
Would have been a small wagon, probably hoses that would have been linked up to that. And so most of these communities did have a volunteer, and many of the communities in central Montana still have volunteer fire departments. And, of course, with all of the wooden structures around and the high winds that occurred out on the plains, fire was always a grave danger. So this would be a part of the central part of the community.
Now we're in a substantially inside, a substantially larger building, maybe 16 by 24. Looks like a lot went on in here. What are we looking at?
Well, this would have been, again, one of the centerpieces of one of these homestead communities. This would have been the local blacksmith shop, probably also a garage where you could have get your buckboard wheels fixed. You could get your early automobiles fixed. And this was kind of iconic because, as we had talked a moment earlier, survival out on the plains themselves after about 1917 was problematic. The war was ending, the price of wheat was plummeting, the drought was occurring, and there wasn't an awful lot of money being made. And so people would come in and take other jobs. In fact, this actual blacksmith shop was one where a fellow by the name of Gazda, operating out in the Janu section, did in fact work 5 days a week and went back to join his wife and his family on weekends. And he made part of the living and keeping the family surviving by working at this blacksmith shop. So there is an interesting human interest story that goes along with this fella and this structure that we're standing in. Gazda, who worked here 5 days a week, communicated with his wife during the working week by carrier pigeon.
And you're joking.
No, and on Fridays, she would actually send him the list of the groceries that she would like to have picked up and brought back to the homestead by carrier pigeon. Well, the apocryphal story is that he's waiting for the pigeon to show up one Friday, and the pigeon comes in, and it's beaten up terribly. It has feathers missing. It looks incredibly bedraggled. He was terribly panicked and worried, and so he jumped on his horse and galloped at full speed for the dozen or so miles back to the homestead itself to find that his wife and children were in fine shape. But he finally figured out that what must have happened was the pigeon, after she had let it go, carrying the note for the groceries, is that it flew through a hailstorm and got beaten up pretty bad. But the family was fine.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Randy Morger, director of the Museum of the Northern Great Plains, about the transition in Montana to homesteading. I'm no expert on blacksmith equipment, but just looking, we've got five different kinds of hammers, all obviously reflecting specialized use, four different types of threaders with which you cut thread into pipe, horseshoes of different sorts, and a forge, obviously where they heated horseshoes and other metal to beat it into the appropriate shape, a drill press that is hand-cranked and large capacity, and hanging on the wall, five different brands, obviously the blacksmiths making brands for local cattlemen. Now you and I are sitting in two chairs with a game of checkers between us, a stove next to us, in what I gather is the general store.
This is a reproduction of what might have been a typical general store of the era, sort of not only the commercial but the social center for a homestead village back on the plains of central Montana. You'll see over my shoulder the post office, obviously a key element in folks' life, and then lining the walls on both sides, both cereals and other goods, the sort of goods that you would buy at a grocery store, and then on the other side, more of your commercial and dry goods. This, by the way, was a reproduction of an actual general store in Fort Benton, and you may have seen the sign outside that said Lehman Brothers. He was an early hardware store owner here, and a lot of the stuff that you see inside comes from the Lehman Brothers, and they still run a hardware store downtown even today.
Looks like a fairly large vault.
Yeah, well, again, one of the things that you'll see here, and then you're going to see again as we go over, if we make it into the city hall, certainly when we make it into the bank, you'll see safes there as well.
And a telephone I'm looking at with no dial.
And just down the street from us, we have another, and this is not a reproduction, this is some of the original telephone equipment that was in Fort Benton in the early 1920s. And again, a key way of people diminishing those distances, both in town and out on the plains. A lot of stories that people still tell today of people from the 40s, 50s, and 60s remembering the party lines, where you would have to have three or four different parties all strung on the same line out in the country.
So if you can't dial a number, that means when you pick up the phone, you're waiting for an operator, correct?
There was, and I think if you come to a small town in Montana, there are people that history is still touching, and you can still remember your own phone number. For example, when I was a kid, I would call the operator in town and say, "Operator, I'd like to have 292W, please," and she'd say, "Hold on just a second, Randy, I'll get your mother."
Advertising was apparently not in its infancy, but there, much milder, Chesterfield cigarettes, Dr. Price's cream baking powder, people made their own baked goods, silk soap, very best for laundry, and ivory soap, which you can still buy. There is also a washing board for sale, because I gather this is in the days before there were washing machines. Corrugated rectangle on which one scrubbed one's clothes. This one is top-notch brand. And a classic ornate cash register with probably 30 different levers indicating different amounts for the transaction. You press them down with your finger. Now we're standing in what appears to be a classic one-room schoolhouse, 11 desks with inkwells for kids, a desk for the teacher, and a picture of President Woodrow Wilson on the wall, and a stove.
Yeah, this is a lovely old structure. This comes to us from Flowery, Montana, one of those homestead communities actually called the Promised Land by folks who are still out there today, and it was constructed in 1913. It actually served as a one-room schoolhouse in the Flowery area well into the 1940s, and it's sort of decorated in that mid-20s style that you might have seen back in that time period.
And this would have been served homesteaders, you said, paid for by homesteaders out on the prairie.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, these were ubiquitous across the landscape, some of them in communities, but others that were just basically easy to get to by a group of homesteaders, and they would put up a school, and everyone would be educated in here from very small children all the way up to folks well past puberty.
We're now seated in one of eight pews, each probably 8 feet long, in the Holiness Church. A small pulpit, piano, a picture of Jesus.
This is a wonderful old church. In fact, we still, from time to time, rent this out for weddings and other celebrations by families. It's a key part of our homestead village. This church came to us from a place called Sample Flat and served the congregation out there well into the 1950s.
We're now standing in the bank.
This reflects the incredible optimism that was ongoing at that time. This is a structure that was built in 1914. Now imagine that, just about the time that World War I is getting started. The start of World War I makes wheat prices absolutely skyrocket. They reach prices of $2 a bushel, unheard of. Those same prices weren't seen again until the 1960s, 1970s in Montana. And at the same time, incredible amounts of moisture, very beneficial rains that did make the legend of this being a land of milk and honey into a reality, at least for those few years. And then 1924 is when this bank went broke and closed. I think 170 banks statewide went bust during the bust of the homestead years, brought on by the collapse of the grain prices and by the climate returning to the climate it had been historically.
And this, of course, is before the hit of the Great Depression.
Montana was deep into the Great Depression long before the Great Depression ever hit the United States as a whole. Many of those 90,000 to 100,000 homesteaders who had streamed into the state over the previous two decades have to fold tents and leave the state. And so you see a population decline for the state of Montana, one of the only states in the Union that saw a population decline in the 20s and the early 30s, to where it stabilized in above about 500,000, but it was 20 or 30 years before the population of Montana really began to grow again.
Randy Morger, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.